It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, walleye are one of the most important fish for Wisconsin's recreation industry and our fish fries, but a new study finds their habitats are dwindling. We'll find out what we know and how our fishing practices may need to change. First, being the parent of young kids is expensive, and one big cost is childcare. Nationally, one in five families spends more than 25% of their income on childcare, and in Wisconsin, it can be between $9,000 and $14,000 a year. That's according to data from the group Childcare Aware of America, which advocates for better access to affordable childcare. And now the issue is getting attention from at least one 2020 candidate for president. Here's Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, a Democrat, talking on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert about her plan.
I put a proposal out for a wealth tax. That would produce, on the richest 75,000 families in this country, 2%. We could take that money and provide universal child care for every one of our children. Universal pre-K.
Hannah Matthews is the Deputy Executive Director for Policy at CLASP, the Center for Law and Social Policy. Hannah, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
What do we know about how much American families, on average, pay for childcare?
Well, we know that it is a lot. It is a huge cost burden for families. You mentioned in your opening the costs in Wisconsin can be $9,000, $12,000 for infant care. Here in D.C., on average, infant care is closer to about $23,000, $24,000. This is a tremendous expense for families. When we actually look across income levels, families that spend money on childcare pay a significant share of their household budget. And that's especially true for lower income families. For families that make under the federal poverty level, those that pay for childcare actually pay over 30% of their income on childcare. So this is a really significant cost for families.
Let's put that into an even bigger context. How do we compare here in the U.S. to other developed nations on the cost of childcare?
Well, other countries have larger public investments in young children more broadly, right? So they have more universal access to early childhood programs. They also have paid leave to support parents when they have a child or need to care for a child. So the U.S. has a long way to go in terms of supporting working families.
I think one of the confusing things about childcare is that it's often a large expense for parents, as we've been saying, but the people working in childcare are often making very low wages, often without benefits. Where does the money go? What is the breakdown there?
That's a really good point. What we have in childcare is just a real failure of the market. As you point out, childcare workers are earning poverty wages. And so if you really think about the kind of compensation that these workers who are doing a tremendously hard job, right? Any parent knows how hard it is to take care of a child, let alone to manage a large group of children. In fact, childcare should cost more if we were really putting the money in to make sure that those providers had decent compensation, had benefits that they often don't have. But we have a market failure. That is that childcare can't cost more because, as we just talked about, parents are already paying a staggering amount of their income to meet those costs. So what we need is a public investment that can actually support that building out of quality childcare and really make sure that we are investing in a system that supports the workers there, that supports children and families. Parents simply can't bear this cost burden alone.
And we'll go a little further on and we'll talk about those possible options. But I want to go back to that money because so we talked about that Wisconsin families are paying between $9,000 and $12,000. I assume that's per child childcare. But I also think that I saw that the average childcare worker in Wisconsin is making $22,000 a year. So it feels like there's a chunk of money that is not, it's getting lost somewhere in between the two.
Well, when you think about how labor intensive childcare is, it's not that there is many childcare providers are not actually operating and actually earning any kind of a profit. They're really operating in the red often. And so that is that if you think about the main costs in a childcare program are the labor costs, those personnel costs. And this is an area where you frankly can't save money, right? You don't want to have fewer teachers in a classroom. What we want in a quality childcare program is very low teacher and child ratios. You want small groups. These are very young children, right? They learn in the context of having individual attention from a caregiver. So personnel costs just take up a very large part of that individual childcare program budget. And as I said, there's just not enough money coming in, even though it seems like you're paying a huge amount of money, which it is for parents. But when we look at the system as a whole, it's just not sufficient, right? So it's the same idea that, you know, if you think of the K-12 system, you know, an individual family, what they would pay for one child, it's just you need support of the public investment there.
We're talking with Hannah Matthews. She's Deputy Executive Director for Policy at CLASP. That's the Center for Law and Social Policy. And we're looking at the struggle to find and support quality and affordable childcare. And as we said, there's the cost aspect, Hannah, but quality is also an issue here. How can we tell if a childcare program is providing high quality care?
So that's a great question. And I think this is something a lot of families struggle with, because it's not just affording care, but it's actually even finding quality care, even if a family were to afford it. This is an area where we have, again, as a country, not made a national investment to building the supply of quality care. We know what quality care is. I talked about the caregivers a few minutes ago. That's really what this comes down to. Children learn in the context of relationships with adults. And so those adults need to have skills and competency and understand early childhood development to truly support children's growth and learning.
So at the very basic level, it's making sure kids are safe, but there's a lot more that can be provided in a quality situation.
Absolutely.
And what do we know about who attends high quality childcare programs versus the ones that are much lower quality?
Well, I have to say that there's not a great deal of high-quality childcare. Even families who are paying a lot of money, upper-income families, have a hard time accessing quality care. Now, we do have one example of quality care that we have would be the Federal Head Start Program, which is a early childhood program for generally for 3 and 4 year olds, although some infants and toddlers. And what sets that apart in terms of quality are the quality standards that are there. So standards around the workforce, standards around what's happening in the classroom. So building on those, that health and safety regulations, but actually looking at what happens in the classroom and the kinds of supports that children are getting.
I'm guessing from a very large scale program like Head Start, we have some good data. Do we know how important it is that children are in quality childcare for setting them up for success down the road?
We actually have decades of research at how important this is. Quality childcare, again, care that meets a set of quality standards, regardless of what we're calling it, whether it's a Head Start program, a preschool program. We know that quality programs make lifelong difference for children. So they help kids with those early foundational skills that help them begin school successfully, get them ready to succeed. And we actually have decades of research that show that as adults, they actually have better employment outcomes, have greater earnings. We know that this is a really worthwhile investment.
I'm also guessing that having a very well-structured and supported program is also a benefit for the parents, not just in how well their kids are being taken care of, but in probably not having to rush away from work because suddenly the child care provider isn't available or other things that would be disruptive to a working parent.
That's right. So child care is a support both for children and for parents. For parents, it makes sure that they have the ability to have more stable employment. As you said, they're not losing out by having to deal with unstable care, which can often leave a parent, arriving at work late or having to turn down work. Parents who have stable child care tend to have higher earnings. They have more stable employment. And again, their whole economics are improved over time, which that also is a win for children, right? We know that when families are more economically stable, it's a support to children as well.
We're talking to Hannah Matthews of the Center for Law and Social Policy about ways to make quality childcare more affordable. And you can join in at 800-642-1422. 1234. How much have you paid for childcare? Was the cost manageable for your family? And if not, what did you do? Was it difficult to make room for it in your budget? And has the cost of childcare affected your life decisions? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about the cost of childcare in the U.S. and Wisconsin specifically. Hannah Matthews is the Deputy Executive Director for Policy at the Center for Law and Social Policy, also known as CLASP. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How has the cost of childcare affected you or your family's lives? If you've used childcare, how hard was it to find affordable and high-quality care for your child? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also tweet us at CentralTimeWPR. And Hannah, let's talk about some of the ways that there have been efforts to subsidize childcare to make it more affordable. What are those programs that are in place right now?
Sure. So the major program, it's called the Child Care and Development Block Grant. This is a federal program. It's a federal to state partnership, meaning the federal government puts in funds and states also contribute. And this is a program that is meant to both improve the quality of childcare, and it also is meant to subsidize the costs for low-income parents so that they can go to school or go to work. And this has been a tremendous important support for low-income families, for the ones that get it. The problem with the program is that it's been built on scarcity. This is a program that until last year, when there was a significant increase in funding, had actually been operating with near flat funding over the past decade. And so right now, it's about 1 out of 6 children who are eligible for the program actually get any help. So that's a large number of families, 85% of kids, right, who could be getting help from this program that aren't able to be served. And what happens in that context of scarcity is that states make a lot of difficult choices. So they can't raise rates that they pay to providers. They can't necessarily expand access. They have to make choices between monitoring for health and safety standards or investing in the training for caregivers. They have to choose amongst these priorities. And what we've seen across the board nationally and is what in Wisconsin as well is that we're actually are serving fewer children than we were back in 2006. And that's just because there simply hasn't been enough level of investment to continue to maintain that number of kids. So in fact, in Wisconsin, when we look at the numbers, we see that right now the program's serving just about 6% of those who are eligible to actually get help.
Let's go to the phones, and Jeff in Superior is up first. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, I respect this subject matter, and I think you're treating it very respectfully. I was one of the few men that they hired when I lived in Seattle. I worked for a year in a daycare center. We took care of kids from 6 months to a year old. And I basically formed the opinion that I think it's parents' responsibility to raise their children, not an institution or the government. And because when the kids bond with you as a healthcare worker, especially if you're a man, you begin to feel guilty about how the child loves you more than his own father. And I just think that really the government should stay out of families in this manner.
Jeff, can I ask you a follow-up question?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm curious, even if with the best of intentions, a family wants to take care of their child within their family, within their own resources, what if circumstances change and there really isn't that option?
After the child's been born,
right.
I think they should make those plans before they decide to have children. I think that the world's overpopulated, and you know, child care is a very serious issue, and I think it should be a family issue. I really don't think government should be involved in it.
All right, thanks for that call, Jeff. Hannah, do you have a response?
Sure. So two thoughts on that. So the first is,
if we just look at the data and where we are as a country, we know that the majority of parents, the majority of mothers with young children are in the workforce. So childcare is an issue that is in front of us, regardless of the choices that, that families make. The second thing that I would say is that I do think that what policymakers and others are really beginning to understand is that childcare isn't just a personal issue or a family issue. There's actually lots of reasons for us to think about this as a country. Our country does better economically when parents have stable childcare, right? We talked earlier about the impacts on employment for parents when they're able to have steady care. And if we look at the strong research base on early childhood, we also know that, again, kids that are in quality care, these are foundational years. They lay a groundwork. They help them as they move forward. That makes a difference for our country, right? So as community members, when we think about the investments in this area, we know that kids who are getting positive experiences early, we're setting them up for success. These are the kids that will be our teachers, the doctors that we're going to need, the scientists. So we need our young kids to be nurtured and prepared for life. And the reality is that parents are working and kids are going to be in care. So I do think it's an economic imperative that we make sure that that care is of the highest quality and kids are getting the supports they need.
We're talking with Hannah Matthews from the Center for Law and Social Policy about the challenge in providing affordable, high-quality child care. Let's go next to Jessica in Watertown. Hi, Jessica.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I was calling. I was just saying that I had to leave full-time employment to care for my son full-time because being on the autism spectrum, he was asked not to return to several places, and it just got to be too much of a burden to my workplace, and so I had to leave full-time employment to care for him. Thankfully, I did have supports financially where it wasn't a financial burden, but it was a burden for him since he didn't have, you know, he was an only child, so he didn't have other kids to play with and socialize.
Thanks for that call, Jessica. And I want to go right to Anastasia in Beloit because I think she has something to add as well. Hi, Anastasia.
Hi. I just, you know, compared to what that last caller had, a pretty similar experience. My son has cerebral palsy, and he has been asked to not return to one day care, and we essentially haven't been able to find him any other option that would be able to take him because he has both sensory and mobility needs. And so I would love to see, you know, more public investment just for the availability aspect of childcare. At this point, my husband works part-time and I work full-time because we haven't been able to find available childcare that will take care of our special needs son.
Thanks so much for both those calls, Jessica and Anastasia. And Hannah, that's a whole other dimension when children might have additional needs that would need to be met in childcare.
That's right. I mean, as hard as it is for all families to find affordable childcare, for families with children with special needs, it is just, as you heard from these callers, just even more challenging, not just in terms of the affordability piece, but having a program that will even take the child and be able to provide the kinds of services that kids might need. And I mean, your caller said it well, right? That the answer here is that families can't do this alone. So a public investment in childcare that makes sure that we have a childcare system that can work for all children is just critically important.
And Hannah, would it take some large-scale, big sweeping legislation or initiative to get some of these good results that we're after? Or are there ways to do this in a more piecemeal way?
Well, I think we are making progress in a piecemeal way right now. So what I would say is that the program that I described earlier, the Child Care and Development Block Grant, that actually got a very large boost in funding last year as a result of a bipartisan budget deal. It had a $2.4 billion increase. There is some sense that there may be some more dollars to come this year. And so that's a really good thing because it's helping to kind of stop that trend that I was describing of fewer children getting assistance. So it's moving in the right direction. But if we're really being honest about the scale of the problem, if we're only serving one out of six kids, then incremental
expansions each year are just going to take far too long to reach the millions of families that need help. So yes, it would take a major initiative. There actually is legislation pending in Congress that has gotten some attention, which would really be a fundamental overhaul of how we provide childcare in this country and make it affordable for all the families that need it.
Senator Elizabeth Warren, a Democratic candidate for president, released, as we heard earlier, a plan for affordable childcare. In fact, it would be free for many people, putting a tax on some of the richest families in the country. Leaving aside the politics of whether that would go anywhere, would that be a good model, that universally available government run and supported childcare?
So I would say there aren't a lot of details on the specifics of that plan, but absolutely. It is really exciting to hear a proposal that really speaks to the need for affordable childcare for all families. I would say from our perspective as an anti-poverty organization, we really are focused on making sure that the lowest income families have access to childcare. And one of the things that Senator Warren's plan does, as you mentioned, it would make the care free for many families, and then would have a sliding fee scale with so the largest subsidies would go to the lowest income families, and that parents would pay a little bit into that program as their incomes grow. So I think that's hugely important. And again, because it's proposing, just like the legislation that's in Congress now, the Child Care for Working Families Act, both of these proposals would just fundamentally overhaul the program so that we would be putting in the level of investment and public resources that are needed, both to make child care widely available and affordable for families, but also to build quality. And so built into both those plans would be supports to the workforce and other ways to really make sure that that quality care is there.
Well, Hannah, thank you so much for spending time with us today and sharing the information.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Hannah Matthews, Deputy Executive Director for Policy at CLASP. That's the Center for Law and Social Policy. She was with us today to talk about how much American families pay for childcare, including those of us in Wisconsin, and ways that we can improve access to it, access to not just affordable, but also high-quality childcare. You can keep the conversation going on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Are you currently paying for childcare? Has it been hard to find childcare, and has it been hard to afford it? How does it fit into your budget? What percentage of your take-home pay are you paying for childcare? And have you had to make choices, like some of our callers shared, of having to leave the workforce or having to split responsibilities for taking care of your children between you and a partner? Let us know what you're thinking by going to the Ideas Network Facebook page and let us know what you're doing for childcare. Walleye is one of Wisconsin's most popular fish, but a study published this week finds their habitats are likely to decline over the next several decades. Researchers investigating a major Minnesota lake found that as water conditions were changing, the walleye population was falling. And that means trouble for Wisconsin habitats as well. They say that in order to maintain sustainable levels of the fish in the future, our fishing habits may need to change. Steve Carpenter is an emeritus professor of integrative biology at UW-Madison. He's also the former director of the UW-Madison Center for Limnology. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
Well, walleye are a really important fish here in Wisconsin. They're a big part of our recreation and, of course, our fish fries. First off, what kind of conditions in our lakes are needed to support walleye?
Walleyes do best in large lakes that have a cold water refuge in the deep water, and they like lakes that have a little bit of staining in them, that sort of iced tea stain that our northern lakes get. Those big bright eyes are for hunting prey. They're not just decorations. They're the way the walleye hunts. And they have an advantage in dark water that other fish do not. So they like water that's a little bit dark, and they like to have a cold water refuge available.
So this study that you were part of looked specifically at Lake Mille Lacs in Minnesota. Can you talk about what the study was looking at and what it found?
Sure. First, by way of introduction, the Mill Locks Project grew out of a project in Wisconsin to try to understand the decline of walleye in our northern lakes. And as you, as your listeners know, we have lost hundreds of lakes in the last decade or so, and we've been trying to figure out what the problem is. And the project started here, but we one of the alumni of the project is Professor Gretchen Hansen, who moved on to work at the University of Minnesota on the faculty there. And she realized that Mill Locks was going through the same sort of decline as the northern Wisconsin lakes. And so she contacted me and my colleagues at USGS in Madison about conducting a study that took advantage of the wonderful long-term data at Mill Locks. In Mill Locks, the walleye have gone through a decline because the lake water has become clearer. And that, in other words, it's losing its tea-colored stain. And the same thing has been happening in Wisconsin lakes. And that loss of the staining takes away habitat.
It's really interesting because I think for lay people like myself, clear water sounds like it would be a good thing, but in this case, it's not.
Well, clear water is really a good thing if we are thinking about toxic algae blooms, as we have in some of the southern lakes in Wisconsin. But in this staining is actually very beneficial for walleye habitat.
So, Steve, you said that we have seen a loss in many Wisconsin lakes to be able to support good fish populations, specifically walleye. What is behind the changing conditions in these lakes? Do we know?
Yes, we do. To some extent, it's climate change. And, of course, climate change is a global problem. But the staining of the lakes is controlled by the timing and amount of precipitation that comes in. And we have had some periodic droughts in northern Wisconsin. And every time we have a drought for a decade or so, we lose walleye habitat. So climate change is one factor. Another factor is habitat destruction around the perimeter of the lakes. So we are losing habitat and access to spawning grounds because of the way people manage their lawns around lakes.
We're talking with Steve Carpenter right now. He's an emeritus professor of integrative biology at UW-Madison. He's also the former director of the UW-Madison Center for Limnology. And we're talking about a study that looks at the declining number of lakes in the coming decades that might be able to support a walleye population. Let's look first, Steve, at kind of worst-case scenario. What did the study's findings predict as far as what Wisconsin lakes might be able to support walleye and how many might not?
A major implication of the study is that at least in some lakes, we need to dial back our harvest. The harvest plan for walleye in Wisconsin was developed in the 1980s. In a famous court case that resulted in a new management plan that involved the tribes and involved the state. And that worked beautifully for many years, but the plan is not working now. And the reason is that we have lost habitat compared to the 1980s. So harvest levels that were sustainable in the 1980s are no longer sustainable due to habitat loss. So our best option is dial back the harvest.
So if we did nothing, there would only, I believe, be a couple dozen lakes in Wisconsin that would still be able to support walleye a few decades out. But it sounds like that doesn't have to be what happens if we follow some management procedures. What would be the ideal way to manage these walleye populations in these lakes that are at risk?
Well, we have to come up with ways to reduce harvest, and that will take a lake-by-lake assessment and the individual lake managers who are responsible for the particular lakes are the they are DNR employees, and they are the people who are the best positioned to do that analysis and set the regulations. So I don't I'm not really qualified to do that.
So this is something that could be directed by the DNR. Would it need any kind of legislative support, or could this just go through that department?
I am a scientist. I am not a politician. As far as I know, this could be worked out by the tribes and by the DNR managers through the process that they go through every year to determine harvest levels.
And Steve, are there other Wisconsin fish species that you anticipate might be seeing similar challenges in the decades to come, given that climate change is likely not going to reverse itself anytime soon?
Well, our other cool water fishes are brook trout, and cool or cold water fishes that are potentially in trouble are brook trout and yellow perch. We have not done a parallel study of yellow perch. I know that DNR scientists have done a study of brook trout, and that fish is in trouble. We are likely to lose our brook trout populations due to climate change.
Well, Steve, thanks so much for joining us today.
You bet. Thank you for the call. It's been a pleasure.
Steve Carpenter is an emeritus professor of integrative biology at UW-Madison. He's also the former director of the UW-Madison Center for Limnology. He was with us to talk about a study that found walleye habitats are under threat from changing lake conditions, and new fishing practices may be needed to keep their populations intact. Cash tips for Wisconsin workers could become tax-free at the state level if new legislation proposed in the legislature is passed into law. The bill is still in its early stages, but Wisconsin could be the first state in the country to enact this kind of tax rule if it's approved. Representative Cody Horlocker is a Republican representing the 33rd Assembly District in southeastern Wisconsin. That includes Mukwonago. Representative Horlocker, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Judith, thanks for having me on.
Of course. You are sponsoring this bill with Republican State Senator Andre Jacques of DePere. What encouraged both of you to pursue this legislation?
Yeah, so this was an idea I had given my time both in college and law school, having worked in the hospitality industry and seeing a variety of different jobs that were tipped, seeing what incentives there are for individuals to provide better service. And in my capacity now as an elected official, how I can use my role to get government off of the back of those working, sometimes in some respects, second jobs to make ends meet. And this is direct tax relief for hardworking Wisconsinites across the board. And, you know, not only does it affect the restaurant industry, but like I said, hospitality, even something like dog grooming could be an area that you would receive cash tips. So there's a wide variety of folks. And as I also stated, individuals working second jobs or moonlighting in some instances that might be able to put a little bit more money back in their pocket that we as a government on the state side now, I can't affect federal policy, but at least from the state side, we know these cash tips are certainly underreported, and this has no impact on credit card tips, which we know is a large, you know, majority of the tips that are currently out there here and now. But as far as the cash transactions that are hard to trace anyway, it's twofold. We're putting more money back in the hardworking Wisconsinites' pockets, and we're decriminalizing the activity of underreporting them, because technically it's tax fraud.
So, Representative Horlacher, you touched on a few things there. One is that this is not just, say, servers in a restaurant or bartenders. I think those are the tipped type of employees that most people think of, but really anyone who might be getting a tip, maybe a hairstylist or, as you said, a dog groomer or a cab driver. So this is anyone who's receiving tips. What exactly would the process be for those folks to not have to pay state income tax on that?
So just for the cash portion of what they're given, right? So if you, whatever industry it is, if you're given a cash tip, we as the state don't care about it. You still have to report those at the federal level. So this isn't going to negatively impact employers that may have to pay the difference between what the amount is under the minimum wage to get those servers or those individuals up to the minimum wage. Because, again, you still have to report that at the federal level. We're just saying from a state perspective, we're going to let you keep your own hard-earned money.
And is there any concern that basically having a different level of income that's reported on the state form would throw off anything with when they're doing their federal filing?
No, because, again, you still have to report the total amount. We're just not collecting that information on the cash transactions at the state side. So you just don't have to pay that state tax for cash.
We're talking with Representative Cody Horlacher. He's a Republican representing the 33rd Assembly District, which includes Mukwonago. And he and State Senator Andre Jacques of DePere are proposing legislation that would make cash tips not taxable at the state level. And Representative Horlacher, what are you hearing from people who are either working in these jobs where they are receiving tips or the people who are employing them?
So broad base of support from folks, obviously, that are in industries that do get tipped, right? And this cuts across the spectrum. This is young folks that are working summer jobs, working during their college years or right out of high school. This is middle-aged folks that are moonlighting, second jobs to put food on the table to save up for maybe vacations. And this is older folks who have re-entered the workforce to maybe offset the cost of their insurance, right? Because that's obviously a whole nother issue that's going on. But again, from that perspective, everybody understands that, yes, these tips are underreported as it is. But really, at the end of the day, we as the state should not be micromanaging a cash transaction of an individual who maybe tips the valet, right? They give them a $5 bill after they go and retrieve the car in the rain. Let that individual keep their money. Let them put that back in. And as I said, working in the hospitality industry through college, I get that this money goes right back into the local economy. It goes into your gas tank. It goes into food for the week. It goes into, in some instances, just paying bills. So there's a lot of different avenues that folks can, get involved with taking this type of opportunity. You know, some of the negative feedback I have heard is that we're just giving a carve out for a select group. But I counter that with there are a lot of different individuals. And as I went through earlier, you know, college age, middle aged, and even some older folks that work in a tipped sort of capacity that can benefit from this. And this is certainly a free market idea, and it's tax reduction and tax relief going directly to hardworking Wisconsinites. If I, as a proponent of Foxconn, can allow for tax breaks for corporations. Why can't I put forward a bill to go, again, right to the individual employees, right? This makes sense because, again, this is going to the individual. This isn't about tax breaks for corporations or anything like that. This is going directly to the individual who is earning that tip. And that is who we're trying to help with this bill.
Representative Horlacher, we have recently actually talked on the show about the challenges that many restaurants and other businesses in the hospitality industry have in finding and retaining staff. Do you see this as a way to make these jobs perhaps more appealing to more people?
Absolutely, 100%. This is going to help the mom and pop industry, those small businesses across the state that employ hardworking individuals that, you know, are going to allow them to take tips, whether it's a supper club, say the Village Supper Club in Delavan, right, near where I grew up. Those types of cottage industries are going to have a leg up on allowing their servers to keep their tips. And I think, again, from the state side of things, it's one avenue that we can take as a government to say, look, keep it. You are going to spend that somewhere else in very, very short order. We know that, right? Again, anybody in the industry knows that's walking around money that is going to go back into their gas tank. It's going to go back into food, or it could go into date nights. Who knows?
And one of the things that you said to specify is that this applies only to cash tips, not to credit card tips. As you said, there are definitely some in the industry who are not claiming those cash tips anyway. So maybe it's not as big of a loss of a tax revenue as one might think. But do you worry at all that if this passes and becomes publicized, that more people might start tipping in cash to be able to provide the person giving them that service that little extra bump?
I honestly hope that is the end result of this, that individuals decide, yeah, we will tip in cash. So it goes directly to the individual. Because again, if the individual has gone above and beyond and provided that level of service that warrants that, absolutely, they should be able and incentivized both as an employer that allows tipping, but we as a government need to incentivize folks to be even better in whatever capacity that they're currently working in, right? And again, this is one of those types of policies that goes directly to that, where, like, if you get a $10 bill for whatever have you, right? Like, even dog groomers, for instance, that's great. Put that towards, you know, your bills for the week, for your cell phone, for whatever. But that money, we know, again, is going to go right back into the economy. This is not the type that's likely to be invested. This is just allowing individuals money to really live on.
And as we start to wrap up, Representative, as you've said, you have worked in the service industry. I certainly have. I know a lot of people who have. It seems like this might be a bipartisan issue. Are you hearing support from the folks across the aisle from you?
Yeah, absolutely. Like with just about every bill I put out there, we try and work both sides of the aisle. We've gone to all of my colleagues in the assembly and have pitched them this idea. And we have received bipartisan support both in the assembly and on the Senate side, because this really is a bipartisan issue. Folks with history in the industry of either hospitality, restaurants, anything where tips are available, understand, yeah, these folks not only work for them, right? This is not just given lightly, but number two, it's an incentive program in order to kind of bolster their bottom line.
And we'll leave it there. Thank you to Representative Cody Horlacher. He's a Republican representing the 33rd Assembly District. He wants to make cash tips tax-free. If you feel passionate about what makes for a good fried cheese curd, you have a chance to make your thoughts known. Through June 3rd, USA Today Network is running a poll of the best place to get fried cheese curds right here in Wisconsin. And Ideas Network producer Chris Molina has some thoughts. Chris, what do you look for?
So a couple of things you're going to want to look for with a good cheese curd. Certainly, I have a couple of establishments in mind. I'm not going to mention those. Don't want to give them
away. Don't want to skew the poll.
But yeah, exactly. But there are a few good factors of cheese curds. I think you need a super, and we're talking fried cheese curds here, the best kind, super light breading, really fresh cheese. And I was thinking about this too. Do you consider the dipping sauce? I mean, I had some cheese curds recently which had a jalapeno ranch dipping sauce. I was like, wow, this is incredible. It wasn't the cheese curd that was so good, but it was the dip.
So the curd was just the carrier.
Exactly. So you kind of have to, I think, really filter out the accoutrement from the actual curd. And that's about the fanciest thing that anyone has ever said about fried cheese curds.
Probably. Well, this is how the leaderboard is shaping up so far. Out of 20 contenders, Main Street Taps in Stevens Point is currently in the lead, with Crawfish Junction in Johnson Creek and Curd Girl in Madison rounding out the top three. You've got till June 3rd to vote, and you can vote once a day. Search for Vote Best Cheese Curds USA Today to find the site, or better yet, find the link on the Central Time WPR Twitter feed. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time.